This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 28th of October, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here at Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Brulé. Coming up on today's show, with the U.S. warship traveling through disputed waters in the South China Sea, will the rising tensions ever escalate into a real shooting war? My guests today, Shawshank Joshi and Isabel Hilton, will discuss that and the day's other big stories. We'll find out what the future holds for Friday's much-anticipated diplomatic summit in Vienna. Can world powers finally figure out a solution to the Syrian civil war? Plus, with the European migrant crisis spiraling out of control, one former Nazi-era airport in Berlin will soon open its doors for the first time since 2008, not to launch any commercial flights, but to house thousands of refugees. That's all to come on Midori House, right here on Monocle 24. And welcome to Studio One on a kind of a rather sort of, wasn't a bad day in London. Seems to be getting a bit sort of damp, and it's certainly dark already at this time of year. My guest today, Isabel Hilton, as mentioned in the intro, editor of China Dialogue, and Shawshank Joshi in his favorite chair in the studio. All other guests know never ever to take the chair on the right hand of the presenter. He's the senior research fellow at the London-based think tank RUSI, and of course they're both regular guests on the program. Welcome.
Thank you.
I wanted to start with the USS Lawson. Of course, we have already been seeing images, certainly first pulling out of port. It's a guided missile destroyer. And of course, passing by this rather sort of interesting reef that has managed to spring up in the South China Sea, the Subi Reef. I wanted to, to start with you, Isabel. There's been so much made of this, whether you're watching CNN, whether you're watching the BBC, or you're even watching the China outlets as well. Just this general sort of sense of Chinese rage. How dare you come so close? America, of course, saying, this is the wide open sea. This is the whole point of the exercise. Is it playing out in a predictable way? I think obviously there's not going to be any shots fired across any bows, obviously. But how do you see this playing out right now?
Well, we hope there won't be any shots fired. It would be a bit of a problem if there were. We've waited a long time, I think, for a material U.S. response, because this creation of artificial islands has been going on for a bit. As you know, the law of the sea does not give you any territorial rights if you claim a rock which is covered at high tide or whatever. So that is not a territorial claim. The Chinese have been busy pouring concrete all over these rocks, which gives them potentially military bases from which to defend a claim were they to lodge a claim in any formal forum. This claim would clearly be challenged. But the Chinese approach has been salami slicing. It's upset all its neighbors, but it's a big, muscular country. And in the end, creating facts in the waves is kind of the game they're at. And that has posed a problem for the US. So how do you respond to small provocations, which constantly kind of advance the agenda, but in ways short of war, short of confrontation? And I think this is a perfectly fair response. Mm. This is, an exercise in protecting open navigation. It's an important sea for everybody, not just for China. Mm. And that is an important principle.
Shawshank, do you think this is also a bit of a precedent setter as well? So all of this goes well for the USS Lawson. It sails through. Everything is fine. And then does that set a similar situation for the Philippines if they want to do it, if Japan wanted to do it as well? Is that part of it? It's a precedent setter.
It is, although I would also say even if China wants to do it, of course, because there are other claims in the South China Sea. They also have exclusive economic zones that some of them claim. China can say, well, if you can put spy ships through our waters, we'll do it through yours. And of course, the Chinese have do it in places like Alaska. They sent a ship through Alaskan waters recently as well.
Yes.
But it's exactly about that. It's really two precedents. One of them is, do you get to keep out other military ships from your exclusive economic zone in the first place? And the second aspect is, do you get an exclusive economic zone at all if you have made up this island by sticking Lego on some underwater rocks until it's a sort of 5-mile runway? So there's two principles at stake, and the US is saying, two-fingered salute to both of them at this point.
Right.
I like the idea of Lego. Maybe Ai Weiwei should build an island in the South China Sea.
Well, I was going to say, also looking at some of these aerial shots, you talked as well about concrete, and what's amazing is, yeah, there's sort of the rather large issue of a very long runway.
Wonder what that's for.
Yeah, wonder what's going to happen there. Probably not charter flights from Hainan or anywhere else. So this is happening at the same time. We'll come back to, of course, the Chinese state visit to the UK in a moment, but also from a media perspective as well. Do you think this is talked up much, or I'm just sort of wondering from a propaganda point of view, do we sort of see heroic symbols of construction workers working on a project like this? What kind of rallying is going on at home, do you think?
We tend to see heroic images of brave sailors defending China's,
Not sweating
territory.
Workmen.
Not so much sweating workmen. And curiously, the United States has been quite modest and shy about this. The Pentagon and the White House haven't really wanted to come out and say, this is what we're doing, so back off. But quietly let it be known that this is what's happening. So, I think that there's a lot of squaring up and chest puffing over this. But the basic difference is that the US is insisting that, there's a rules-based order and there's a way of settling these things, slightly hampered by the fact that they never signed up to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which is, slightly weakens their case.
But they say they abide by it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It just would be nice to sign it. Yeah. Nice to be able to waive it. and of course, the Philippines has been, trying to get a settlement under that convention from China. And China has been, again, not acknowledging the case, but answering it. So there's an awful lot of symbolic, shadow play going on in this game.
Who's watching this most closely within the neighborhood? Is it a Manila story? Is it a Taipei story as much as it's a Tokyo story as well?
Yeah, there's a specific issue about the territorial dispute, and there you have, of course, the Philippines and countries like that watching closely. Mm. But there's a bigger issue here as well, which is about perceived American reliability, risk acceptance on behalf of allies, the meaning of the pivot in practice, and of course, then it's a Tokyo story, it's a Taipei story, it's even a New Delhi story in the biggest sense of, grand strategy in Asia. Mm. How much risk is Washington willing to take for China? This is a pretty simple operation. The question is, what if China ups the risk over the coming years? It won't confront or shoot down a U.S. plane or blow up a U.S. destroyer, but what if it puts new obstacles in the path, meaning that the U.S. has to then sail through more Chinese vessels? We've seen the Iranians do it in the Gulf.
Yeah.
They haven't blown up a U.S. boat just yet, not for some years anyway, but they certainly make you confront gunboats speeding at you, shouting at you, threatening you, and then it hits the headlines, and then the stakes are raised. So the question is, how far is the U.S. willing to go if China resists these kind of operations down the line?
But then the bigger prize, of course, for China is to keep the U.S. out of the Pacific entirely. And if you look at their naval development, it is all about denial of access to the United States Navy.
Yes.
It's about how to sink an aircraft carrier. It's about how to make it too dangerous for the U.S. to fulfill its promises to its allies.
And probably sort of no surprise as well that we have the Pentagon announcing that they're going to go with Northrop Grumman for their next generation long range bombers, which very firmly this is about also a first strike against China, with China being able to, of course, much more blue water in terms of
I'm not sure it's about a first strike. Actually, it's about the fear that a Chinese first strike will take away your bases in Japan. Mm. It'll take away Guam. It'll take away your carriers, as Isabel just said. So this is really about making sure you can have any kind of strike at all after the Chinese have reduced bits of Japan to a smoldering wreck.
Isabel, just maybe before we move on topic.
On that cheerful
I was
going
to sound that happy note. It was like conjured up a few images there, Shawshank. We shouldn't forget as well, I mean, we started this talking about sort of shots across the bow, that the Chinese have intercepted, U.S. reconnaissance aircraft before, a rather embarrassing incident of course, the U.S. having to, get their personnel out of there. Could we quite easily see something like that again,
Yeah, that's always the problem when you get this kind of square off, that you get some kind of shock jock, either, in charge of a patrol boat or in charge of a fighter plane. The personalities of people who fly those things tend to confrontation. And the last episode, the one you're talking about, the Chinese pilot just flew too close. He miscalculated.
And
he didn't paid for it.
That was 14 years ago. And you remember the incident that followed, Tyler, the letter of the two apologies and how difficult it was to compromise on both sides. Now, 14 years on, China's a different place. There's different nationalist sentiments that were perhaps more dormant 14 years ago. And I wonder if it would be far harder to get U.S. airmen released from an island were we to repeat that today.
Let's just rewind to the state visit last week. I was before we went on air as well. I was watching the front pages of the papers, and not just the South China Morning Post, but just looking at all of the Chinese dailies in Hong Kong last week. And so we saw all of these images of the visit. But of course, I don't read Mandarin. I'm not sure how broadly covered it was in the Cantonese papers. But nevertheless, how much of this was a story about we're calling it special relationship on this side. What was the story that was playing out if I was picking up the paper in Guangzhou or Beijing or anywhere else?
Well, I think at some level it kind of confirmed the Chinese perception of Britain as rather quaint. Lots of gilded carriages and horses and oh gosh, there's a queen and all that stuff. That went down quite well because the Chinese, they like a good display like everybody else. I don't think it would have persuaded them. I mean, the other thing is that whatever you think of the regime and whatever you feelings about it, there is a strong sense of national pride in China, and you like your leader to be treated with a certain respect, and that's fine. Taking Britain seriously as a major economic partner, I think is a slightly bigger ask for any skeptical Chinese reader. What is there, what Britain is giving, and it seems to me not getting a huge amount in return, is credibility over the kind of the next stage of China's development and export. So the nuclear plants, the building of infrastructure, the internationalization of the renminbi, all that tricky stuff, which depends on kind of solid rules-based reputation building, Britain is lending a big hand to that. And I think once that hand has been shaken, China will kind of move on and, then take that to the rest of the global market.
Yeah. I guess there's two things. Does it seem a little bit, I guess from a Beijing perspective, it's a little bit of just, box ticking, we've done it. But also from a UK point of view, a little bit late to the party in terms of orchestrating this state visit. And goodness, also to get a multi-entry visa, it goes from whatever, £300 now to 80-ish pounds. Thoughts on that?
I always think it's incredible how gullible states are when other countries tell them, you are our partner of choice. You are our number one friend. And in this particular case, assuming that, we can turn up like this and usurp every other European state, somehow leapfrog, everyone else in importance. But we believe it when China says this. We convince ourselves, we can make ourselves more relevant, more important than Berlin through these kind of steps. What struck me about the past several weeks is just what an incredible vacuum our discussion took place in. It was relentlessly about the UK and China, as if that relationship occurs completely in isolation from our multi-decade-long relationship with the United States and the trust between the bureaucracies deep down inside where they are building our nuclear warheads, our relationship with Japan, with India, in Asia. None of it mattered for the past 2 weeks. It was all swept off the table.
I couldn't agree more. And I, that awful speech that George Osborne made in the Shanghai Stock Exchange, where, he brought Britain's foreign policy down to sort of kindergarten playground statement of we must stick together. And you think, what What exactly is that as a statement of foreign policy at a time when Britain's oldest ally is about to sail into the South China Sea and defend freedom of navigation? So who exactly are we sticking with this week? I haven't I haven't heard any of the British government give any response on that. But, you know, is the United States going to be quite as enthusiastic about supporting British interests at some future moment?
Absolutely.
I thought it was completely reckless behaviour on the part of a man who's meant to be the finance minister.
And who will, of course, you know, has a pretty good chance of being our next prime minister and will have to make these decisions at an even higher level of judgment.
Well, I hope someone gives him some proper reading before he does that.
But, and well, just staying maybe taking away from the geopolitical note, but to economics, if I'm an entrepreneur sitting in Shenzhen, Isabel, or you know, or Chongqing, or whatever the city may be, what did I take away from that? If you know, if I'm sort of, you know, part of, you know, this emerging, you know, merchant class in China, you know, what did I make of this?
Well, I think if you're the emerging merchant class in China, you've got a number of problems. One is that your economy is slowing, and the returns on your investments at home are pretty poor. So finding things to invest in abroad is absolutely fine. And we see a lot of, call it capital flight or, you know, outward investment from China these days for those reasons. China is spreading its risk. I don't think that Britain is doing quite the same thing. Britain seems to be betting the farm on the Chinese economy at a time when the Chinese economy, honestly, is facing a lot of challenges.
Mm. And if you were an entrepreneur, maybe not part of emerging, maybe the declining merchant class in this country, I mean, do you suddenly sort of, you know, look at this and think, okay, you know, fantastic. There is a perceived special relationship here, Shawshank. And I might as well, you know, head off to China and see what kind of deals I can cut, you know, for whatever sector I happen to be in.
This is an incredibly top-heavy relationship that is being cultivated. If you look at the sum total of investments, it was all in big infrastructure, big state-to-state projects, state-shepherded projects. We're not cultivating the kind of relationship where there's a flood of people-to-people contact, where business groups are getting together, where, you know, I could successfully navigate the local complexities, political and economic, in a market in China. You know, this is a very sort of almost corporatist way of pursuing this relationship.
Also, I think the numbers are pretty dodgy. You know, before the visit, they talk about 20 billion, then it went to 30 billion, now it's 45 billion. But if you disarticulate all the announcements, you don't get anything near that. Mm. Or you get promises. And the Chinese have been going around the world making huge promises about infrastructure, which doesn't actually happen. You know, if you look at the last Latin America tour, there were an awful lot of promises out. Very little of it has been realised. So I think when we come back and look at this in a year's time and say, so what was that 46 billion exactly? You might find it's a lot less than you think.
Indeed. It's just 16 minutes after the hour of 1800 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. My guests today, Shawshank Joshi and Isabel Hilton. We're going to take a very short break. We're back right after this.
The Arctic is one of the more inhospitable places on Earth, but as Monocle's film crew discovered, there's a trove of stories to be told by the local media about the vast and varied Canadian Arctic.
You start looking at residential school relocation, you start looking at missing and murdered Indigenous women, you start looking at food security and the incredibly high suicide rate here in Nunavut. If we wanted to, as a network, just stick to those stories, we could be the saddest show on Canadian television. You have to balance some of that out with some uplifting stories to show people struggling against those conditions, but winning.
Reporting the Arctic, now showing along with over 500 more Monocle films and slideshows on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House. You're listening to Midori House. My guest today, Shawshank Joshi from RUSI here in London and Isabel Hilton from China Dialogue. I guess it wouldn't be a Wednesday edition of this program or any edition at the moment if we didn't turn our attention to Syria. All eyes will be firmly focused, lenses as well, in Vienna this coming Friday when we see a rather sort of serious international summit of scale going back to that question of how do you solve a problem like 21st century Syria. So you have to do it in 40 words or less, Shawshank.
40 words or less. Very easy.
But maybe just set it up for us, though, slightly. Yes, the convening of this, who are the major brokers, at the table? I mean, the ones that we really want to hear from, and I guess rather hard to gauge expectations, if any.
Well, the interesting thing about this is that as Groundhog Day as it may seem, it's actually a big deal, because for the first time in a long, long time, you've got the big four. You've got the United States and Russia on opposite sides, but then obviously you've also got two of the rebels' key backers, Saudi Arabia and Turkey, who more than anyone else in this entire conflict, more than some rebels, I would even say, want Assad to go and demand Assad goes and see him as the core, the very nub of the problem. And then, of course, Iran may or may not be coming. It's been probably invited. It may or may not turn up. So I don't think anything will come of this. I do think it is great that we have convened the group. But I think we're at the point where we're bargaining with Russia and saying, you know, it's just if you're haggling in Russia, you say to Russia, I'll give you £100 for that. And they say, no, 500. You say, okay, 200. They say 500. And you go on and on, and you just crawl closer to their point until they just sit back and think, why should I bother negotiating? They're just crawling right to me. And I think we're still at that stage in the conflict.
I mean, from a diplomatic position, and those who may not be close to it, and certainly in the way that Russi would look at it, I mean, how much discussion is already in play right now between all of these people who are going to, of course, be showing up in the next 48 hours?
There's a lot of discussion. It's been going on since July. We saw, Ali Mamluk, a really senior Syrian regime official who went to Jeddah, to a state that was backing the rebels against his own country. We saw Russian and Iranian ministers meet in Tehran. So there's been huge amounts of diplomacy for several months. There have been, right to the point where people are swapping names between Moscow and Washington on who could serve in a future Syrian government, like top Trumps. He's acceptable to me. He's not. I think he'd be good for the Sunnis. No, I veto him. So the discussions are all there. The question is Russia really serious about pushing Assad away at a time when they have just saved his bacon? And I think for me, the answer is no, not yet.
Is your view on that? And I'm wondering, I guess, sort of, what prodding or very, very large carrots, it takes to, of course, change the Putin view, as it stands with Syria at the moment.
Well, I think Putin has all to gain from this situation, doesn't he? I mean, he reemerges as a power broker. He asserts Russia's importance in the world. He's a military player in it, you can't reach deal without him. That's a huge set of gains for Russia.
That's the win, that you can't reach the gain without him. That is it. That's what he wanted.
And he's got that. So he can hang. He will spin that out, it seems to me, as long as he can. In the end, I think he may or may not sacrifice Assad. I don't think he cares about Assad, but he does care about Russia being the power broker. And that's his game.
I think he'll want to see how the offensive plays out. If his aircraft can work with the Iranians on the ground to retake northwest Syria over the next few weeks, great. Then he'll may sit back and say, well, Assad's pretty strong. Why should I compromise? I'd like to see a transitional government that involves one person leave, but the rest of the regime stays.
But I'm trying to imagine in a year's time, if you were trying to put Syria back together again, what would it seriously look like? Who would you still have to deal with on the ground? Because we're talking as though, it's just a deal around a table. But of course, it's not. Have very, very powerful resistance on the ground, and you've lost a lot of territory. What is Assad Syria at this point? It barely exists.
Sure. Well, I mean, if we look at two of the strongholds, and let's go back to sort of garrisons in far flung places, is about how much of this is also just from a very a purely Putin selfish point of view, having a proper foothold, airfield, of course, full refueling facilities in the Eastern Mediterranean now.
Well, yes, there is that. But also that was his way back in. And I think that the bigger game is the one we just described, which is Russia counts.
Yeah.
And yes, of course, he will hang on to that base, and that base is desirable and useful, but it just gets him back in the game.
From your point of view, and going back to, obviously, when we look at even the mobilization in numbers now, and I don't know if anyone saw those incredible images, but they do love a jib and a rig and maybe a drone, not just for strikes, but certainly just to go and, you know, do the grand reportage when they do a deployment. I thought they were sort of making a film when we saw the first, aircraft, the refueling men, everybody who was there. I mean, it was really extraordinary. In the same way when you sort of see either Medvedev or Putin come to the Kremlin as well, there's always some a big sort of swooping crane shot.
You're referring here to the Russia Today film.
Could be Russia Today film. Yeah.
There was a live stream from Latakia. Yeah,
exactly.
And it was incredibly produced, watching Russian jets take off, kill all the terrorists, return successfully, Top Gun style.
Absolutely. And yes, like Afghanistan never happened. But that aside, how much of this as well, and I just want to go back to maybe sort of the domestic story, back in Russia, you see these Russia Today images, you imagine that, of course, that they're, of course, across every sort of domestic channel. Do you think this is sort of, second or third item? If I'm tuning into a Russian newscast right now, look at the heroism of us in Syria at the moment.
It's a fine balance. On the one hand, very high up is the narrative of standing up to Obama, preventing regime change of the sort that destroyed Libya. Look at it now. And Russia matters again. That's high up. Mm. But competing with that and an intrinsic part of it is the bad news story as well. And how do you suppress that? How do you contain that? Because we have seen this week, of course, the first Russian casualty out of Syria as well. The Russians claim he killed himself, but of course he had wounds on his body. The family contests the story. It just doesn't add up. In Ukraine, it was solved by suppressing the entire story. We don't have people in Ukraine. How could anyone have died if we don't have anyone there? In Syria, it's acknowledged. It's a big song and dance, as you say. So they now have to get the casualty story right. And I think, indeed, I partly hope, although one shouldn't hope this too much, that they do run into more serious trouble to the point where they are forced to negotiate more seriously than they are at the moment.
We should probably just move on in the final few moments. And we were talking at the top of the program. Anyone who used to fly into Berlin with any regulator will, of course, know and probably miss Tempelhof Airport, a rather sort of remarkable structure, hangover, of course, very much so symbolically from the last war. But this was, really sort of the original sort of short takeoff and landing airport, landing right in the city center. Anyway, Tempelhof, as we know, is closed. You've still got Tegel and you've still got that rather sort of small issue of a very large and expensive airport that still hasn't opened either in Berlin. Anyway, Tempelhof has been turned into a trade fair site for the past few years. We've now heard that the doors are going to be thrown open and it is going to become a very, very large refugee center. There's a certain symbolism to this on many levels. Is about partly, of course, the role that this center played during the last war and memories hanging very, very heavy. It seems like this week there's been so much written in the international press, more in the German press as well, really sort of talking about, this could be sort of, final game for Frau Merkel. And I'm wondering, when we look at it, right now, if we look across 2016, by next summer, do you think we're still there? And does it come down to a slower trickle if it's a very bad winter? If the flow of refugees indeed does slow, if German infrastructure or German social services can get on top of things, does it come good for her?
It's hard. That's a very hard call. I mean, there is certainly some very nasty. Yeah, there's some very nasty groundswell opposition building. I still think that the majority is with Frau Merkel. She has a very long and substantial track record. She's essentially trusted. This is clearly an uncomfortable moment, but it's not that that all of Germany is rejecting this. I think as long as the winter does slow down the flow, and I think it will, it just gets harder to get there. It gives them some breathing space to perhaps sort out a European approach. You have to hope. Mm. And certainly the Germans, if any country is capable of organizing and servicing this extraordinary influx, it's Germany. So I think that if there is at least some sense of progress and order back in the issue by next spring, she'll be okay. Mm.
Sasha, do you think that we're going to perhaps have fewer people throwing around the term Mutti in affectionate terms when we think of the Chancellor right now?
I think it's interesting. What they care about is competence. Can she deliver on what she has, the task she's taken on? They don't object to the task. They don't object to the moral challenge she set. They do object to her being able to do what she said. And there, I think, is the interesting question. 700 people a day arriving, getting accommodation for them. I think she still has the administrative capacity to pull that off and still retain a great deal of that affection. But this will really tax her powers of governance. And I think that'll be the challenge this time next year.
And if we're to look ahead, would she go gracefully, do you think? Or you'd really need to see the knives come out? I mean, does this come to sort of confrontation land? I think not just her own party, but of course also those in the outer periphery.
I don't think she'd go gracefully, no. I think she's there's a bruiser in there.
All political careers end in failure.
We're going to have to leave it there. Isabel Hilton and Shashank Joshi, very good to see you. Very good to see you always in your regular seat. That's all the time we have for today's edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Clara Strunk. And our studio manager today is Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Josh Fennert will be keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist at 1900. Daniel is here with our weekly business program, The Entrepreneurs. And of course, at 2200, it is going to be the Monocle Daily. The show is going to be back at the very same time at 1800 London time tomorrow. But for this edition of Midori House, I'm Tyler Brulé. Goodbye.